The New Hollywood Podcast is presented by Visit West Hollywood. We would also like to thank today's partners, Callie Love, Inkbox, West Elm, and of course, Visit West Hollywood. Pulsing in the heart of LA, West Hollywood is home to the iconic Sunset Strip, diverse Santa Monica Boulevard, and fashion-forward design district. Learn more at visitwesthollywood.com.
Hey guys, this is Amanda Nduka. This is part two of Deadline's New Hollywood podcast from Sundance. This, our guests are Matt Turnauer, who is the director of a documentary called Where Is My Roy Cohen? And Patrice Kohlers, who is a co-founder of Black Lives Matter and also is subject in a documentary called Bedlam, which is focused on mental illness and how it's kind of been treated and basically how it's kind of been swept under the rug for a long time in this country. And we just engage in a really, really deep discussion about politics, about policy, and about basically how it's funny how they both of these documentaries tackle two different subjects, but there's a through line. This is part two of Deadline's New Hollywood podcast from Sundance. Enjoy.
Thank you guys so much for doing this, coming to the New Hollywood podcast. It's very much appreciated.
Thank you.
Yeah. So this panel is all about how documentary film is important for untold history of underrepresented voices and their cultural significance. And each of your films deal with the relevant issues of today. But before we dive deep into those, can you tell us, you know, the catalyst in, you know, yeah, talk about the film.
Can you just give us a little intro to your films, both of you guys? Sorry,
Ross. Should I go first?
Yeah.
Sure. The film's called Where's My Roy Cohn? It's about Roy Cohn, who is, or was, he died in 1986 of complications from HIV/AIDS. He was the dark, string-puller Svengali of American politics who connects, believe it or not, Senator Joseph McCarthy in early 1950s. He was the right-hand man to McCarthy, and he was the mentor and really the creator of Donald Trump. So it's extraordinary that someone who's been dead since 86 is credited with creating almost entirely a president who was only elected in 2016, but that this person has deepest roots in the previously darkest period of American history since the Second World War. And there are links between these two figures and these two times, and this movie connects the dots.
Thank you. Hey, everybody. Super good to be here. Grateful for this conversation, and this is my first Sundance.
Oh, welcome.
So the documentary film that I'm being featured in is called Bedlam, and it's the story of folks with severe mental illness, the advocacy around it, and the work that Los Angeles County, the county I'm from, but also this country really has to do in repairing the harm against people who have severe mental illness. It follows four families. I'm one of the families. My brother actually is living with schizoaffective disorder and has been criminalized by the LA County system and has spent majority of his life, childhood, and also adult life in incarceration or in some sort of lockdown psychiatric facility. And while the film is incredibly challenging to witness, it's also really moving and empowering because you get to see these families over a six years of living, figuring out how to cope with a mental health care system that is completely neglecting and abusing the people in it. And when I met Ken, the director, Ken Rosenberg, I had just started a local organization called Dignity and Power Now, and our work was specifically looking at the abuse of people with mental illness inside the county jails. And my brother was one of those people who were brutally beaten by the sheriff's department, and he was also diagnosed at the same time that he was being abused. And so there's a long history of the county jail system locking up people with mental illness. LA County Jail is the actually largest mental health provider in the country. It serves over 1,400 people who have mental illness. And so it's a crisis. Mm-hmm. And the documentary exposes that crisis. But it also gives a human face to the people who are living with it every day and the families who are basically being forced to be social workers, case managers. And then you witness families who literally just can't do it anymore.
Sorry. I was just taking that all in. Yeah. So, Patrice, what compelled you to open up about your brother's story in this documentary? It's inspiring, but it's also so frustrating and disheartening to see the type of things that he's gone through, and the type of neglect that he's experienced. What was the bigger picture in your head when you decided to sign on for this documentary?
Well, I wouldn't have signed on if my brother didn't want to. So Ken was actually filming inside of the psychiatric facilities at USC LA County. And my brother was in a really bad manic episode. Our family had attempted to treat him outside of psychiatric care. We had him see a psych doctor. We had him living in our home. We were giving him medication, but we just could not get him to a better place. And so 5 days into trying to care for him as a community, we made a decision with him to take him to the hospital. And when we took him to the hospital, Ken was filming. I didn't know that because I wasn't inside the psych facility, but I got a phone call from a good friend of mine who was a nurse inside the county facility. And we had kind of already figured it out. My brother has a really good network. So people who, if you see the film this week, you'll see the community behind my brother and what it means to have community when you have severe mental illness. And so my good friend, I had told my friend, you know, my brother's going to come in. Can you keep an eye on him? And I got a phone call after my brother was released from my friend Robin saying, hey, there was this psych doctor who's also a director filming in the psych ward, and he's interested in your family story. And I was like, that's weird. And I got on a call with him, and he was super authentic. And I was like, well, let me ask my brother. And I talked to Monty, and he said no. He's like, I'm not interested in that. And I said, okay. And I backed off, and so did Ken. And then my brother went into another episode. And in that episode, when he was kind of getting better, he called me and said, I want to tell my story. And I said, okay, let's call Ken.
And as Dino mentioned earlier, you are the co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement. And you, in the film, you credited your brother with encouraging you to get into advocacy. Why do you think that, specifically in the mental health space, but why do you think that this illness is so largely ignored in the Black community and not seen as an actual illness? Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, I think mental health is a really new concept. And so people can see if your arm's broken. People can like test if you have cancer. But mental illness is largely misunderstood. I mean, you could talk to any psychiatrist and they'll be like, yeah, we don't really know what mental illness is. We sort of just like experiment with these drugs to help, hopefully, folks, right? And so I think that's sort of the overall thing, and I think inside the Black community, there's a long history of seeing vulnerability as a sign of weakness. And so, or just, you know, how many times have you heard, you know, Black families say, oh, he just needs some rest.
Or prayer.
And my family was not like that. Once we knew that Monty had a mental illness, We were big advocates, but that's not every family. And I think that there's a long road that we have as a country and really coming to terms and reckoning around mental illness and the types of actual care people need when they're in the middle of episodes also, but to be preventative. My brother could have had early treatment early on and did not receive that.
So Matt, with Where's My Roy Cohn, what was the catalyst and like what sparked your will to make this documentary?
Well, I was looking at another type of crisis, but I believe a crisis, which was the election of Donald Trump as president, and started making the movie the day after. Its origin was sort of strange. I was making a movie that premiered at Last Sundance called Studio 54 about the nightclub. Roy Cohn was the lawyer for that club, and he lawyered the clients, the owners of the club, into the longest prison sentence ever given for tax evasion. Roy Cohn was actually quite a good lawyer, but this was a very misguided effort. And in any event, long story short, I was looking at archival of him all through the election year and thinking, why hasn't anyone done a Roy Cohn movie, because he's such a compelling character? And then I thought, well, it's really the story about Roy Cohn's connected to Trump, and Trump will lose, and we'll never have to think about Trump and Roy Cohn again. Then I was like, all of us probably in this room, I was pretty shocked. And then I thought, well, this is a movie that has to be made, because it's an undertold story, because we all thought we were rid of Roy Cohn and his malign influence. And everyone really, and this is why, part of the reason that Trump was elected, why we weren't looking, so to speak, is that we thought, too many people thought it was a joke, and we didn't identify the markers in our society that led to this crisis, which Roy Cohn's responsible for a lot of that, which is the reason for the film.
So with such a fascinating subject that you have, was there anything surprising that you found out? And part two of this question is, when you were making the film, how much of his, you know, homosexuality did you want to weigh in on his narrative?
Full exposure. well, part of what made Cohn or makes him a compelling figure is that he was gay. He was deeply hypocritical about his homosexuality in so many different ways. I'm sort of astonishing how many ways he found to be a hypocrite about being gay. Now, I want to preface this by saying he was born in 1927, and he was a man in public life. It was impossible to be really an out man in public life. We have to realize the context of all of this. But Roy Cohn, along with his mentor, one of his mentors, J. Edgar Hoover, another closet homosexual, helped make it even worse and perpetuate the just impossibility of being an out gay person in the mid-20th century. Cohn's hypocrisy was complete. He helped Joseph McCarthy create the Lavender Scare, which was the companion to the Red Scare. The Red Scare was to root out communists, mostly people who weren't communists but were falsely accused and whose lives were ruined. The Lavender Scare was the same thing for gay people. And they wanted to root them out of the State Department and the Army and every part of the government. And these laws, by the way, were on the books until, I believe, the Clinton administration, if I'm not mistaken. It was very late when they were taken off the books. And it just so happens that two gay men were responsible for much of that kind of law enforcement panic that led to this deep hypocrisy. Cohn's hypocrisy continues on down into his life. This is even without touching on Donald Trump. It's how ugly it is. When he was a political force later in his life and the ultimate behind-the-scenes string puller in politics and the whole power structure of the country involving the mafia and its involvement with the government, Roy Cohn's at the center of all that. He helps get Ronald Reagan elected president. And his very good friends, Ronald and Nancy Reagan, of course, ignore the HIV crisis and create extraordinary damage in perpetuating a pandemic. Meanwhile, when Roy Cohn's diagnosed with AIDS during the Reagan presidency, they did everything they could to get him special treatment and experimental treatment at the National Institute of Health. And there are telegrams from Ronald Reagan to Roy Cohn in the hospital where Reagan had placed him to assure that he would live longer, saying, "Nancy and I send you all of our love and our best wishes and Godspeed for a recovery." So we're exposing in this film the deepest and darkest levels of hypocrisy in government that led to you-know-who.
And Voldemort.
We're living all of this again, and that touches everything. Yeah. So we're talking about a narrative here about a white privileged male, by the way, but now Donald Trump is president and every vulnerable minority is really in a horrible, horrible position. It doesn't matter who you are. One day you could be Muslim, one day you're African American, one day, who knows, you're Jewish. I mean, it's everyone. Vulnerable minority is all of us, really, in one way or another, with very few exceptions. So the film is a clarion call before we're overwhelmed by a rising tide of, frankly, fascism that Trump represents, to understand where this came from. And if you understand that, you can help prevent it.
Oh.
God. I just dropped my
wig snatch.
That's okay. So I want to, you touched on, like, you know, this kind of, we continue to see the same behavior throughout history. We continue to see perpetuated behavior throughout history. So with documentary filmmaking is supposed to, you know, shine a light to these behaviors there and everything. How do you guys feel like, do you believe that we can still learn from our history? Do you still have faith? And this is for both of you, because even with Bedlam, it's like they started from, you know, this first asylum being made and to bringing it to today. And obviously with the Roy Cohn, we're seeing the same, it was so crazy. You're seeing the same rhetoric that Trump uses, he was using back then. Like, it's,
that's like, oh, how many years?
That was how many years, but you're still seeing it and people are still latching onto it. So do you guys feel like documentary filmmaking could really, what kind of change do you guys see documentary filmmaking could do?
So I think storytelling is incredibly important, and any type of narrative really helps support having a conversation, exposing. I think documentary film in particular, I'm like a big fan of documentary films. It's a large way I was politicized as a young person, because living in a country that has amnesia, living political amnesia, living in a country that denies people's basic human rights while also saying that everybody has access to them. and so I have always been sort of the personality that wanted to know another truth. And documentary film had allowed me to know other truths. And so I think documentary film is incredibly important. It's incredibly necessary. It also allows for us to have a different type of conversation. It's often juxtaposed to bright, shiny Hollywood that is glossy and Disney-fied and has a very superficial conversation about something. A documentary film gives a raw, unadulterated version about what's actually happening. And I think we don't do that enough in this country. And we're often the ones to sort of like turn our face away from it. And I think documentary film is like a mirror. Like, you have to witness this. Yeah. You have to watch this. And if you don't, your life may depend on it. And so I think it's incredibly important.
And there's no like creative license. Like, everything is what it is. Like,
well, I think there's creative license.
Well, when I say that, I'm saying like changing the story to fit some type, whatever your narrative is.
Well, I think everything is telling a story based off of your narrative, and I think that's not a bad thing. But I think what good documentary film gives you enough information for you to say, yeah, I can't actually deny that. Yeah. It gives you enough information for at the end of the day, you will have to still be a bigot if you're like, well, let's still build a wall, right? Mm. After you received all of this information, that's you being in denial about the thing.
It's funny, your comments are crossing over with mine that I made previously today. So I feel it's harmonic convergence here.
We bring people together here at New Hollywood.
I've been quoting the writer Gore Vidal all week in this, answering a similar question. He used to call it the United States of Amnesia.
Absolutely.
And that's really what motivates me as well. You know, we're all drinking from the fire hose of cable news and Twitter now. And great, if you to be informed is to live. There's no question. But it's very difficult in the wired media world and the 24-hour news cycle to actually take stock of what the origins of the story are and the context of the story and the deeper meaning of it and how it affects us. That's what documentary is really, really good at. And you take 90 minutes, generally, to tell your story, and sometimes now in the age of the doc series, you take many hours to tell it. This is a great thing, actually. So the more attention that this form can get, and it is being popularized because of many platforms in the media now, I think, and the more people we can get to watch and pay attention, I think the better off we are. I'm completely obsessed with politics and news, and I find myself overwhelmed by Politico and the New York Times and the Washington Post and all the apps on my phone. So if I'm feeling overwhelmed, I know that most people are actually shutting off. So to tell the story in a different form that's more like a movie and more like, frankly, an entertainment, there's nothing wrong with that, I think is really, really vital. And Sundance has always been a platform for that, actually. So it's appropriate that we're here. And clearly talking the same language. You know.
That's why we brought you together. It's not a coincidence, guys.
Did you make this in mind? Do you have an audience in mind for this?
I always make my films for general audience. I come up from journalism. I come from general interest journalism, which might be going the way of the dodo bird, actually. I'm a little sad about that. I mean, the New York Times is... important newspapers are having a renaissance now because, ironically, of Trump. But the general interest magazine of Vanity Fair is where I had started my career and wrote for years. Those are suffering right now. Documentaries are sort of taking their place, but I think we're at a very confusing time. Anyway, the first question the journalist who wrote about the film, which just premiered yesterday, asked me was, how are you going to reach the other side?
Yeah, that's what I
mean. Yeah, and I frankly don't have an answer to the question because people are so dug in. And I have Sirius radio in my car, and I'm always listening to MSNBC, of course, so I have like Rachel Maddow and Chris Hayes, and it's all coming at me. And then sometimes I will flip to Fox, actually, to try to understand and listen to what the rhetoric is. And it's dispiriting, not because it's fascist, which it is oftentimes. It's dispiriting because it's a narrative that is an opiate to political camp that won't listen. And then I guess you could say the same for the liberal side. I think that's a false equivalency, because I think that I'm just going to use the term fascism here. I think that we're really on the cusp, okay? And the big lie was something that Goebbels perpetrated for Hitler in World War II. During the McCarthy period, when Harry Truman was president, when Harry Truman left office, he gave a speech denouncing McCarthy and saying that this was wrong and un-American. Dwight Eisenhower was just about to become president as a Republican. Harry Truman says McCarthyism. He says, I'm not talking about the senator from Wisconsin. I'm talking about what he stands for, which is the big lie. And he uses Goebbels's term, actually. Uses a term associated with Nazi propaganda to call it what it was. That type of demagoguery is a fascistic force in the country. Be very, very careful about this right now, because Trump somehow, in his savantness, because I think he is a kind of an idiot savant, has figured out how to command the tools of the modern media. And that is the big lie, and fake news is the big lie. Fake news is, I had never used the term fake news, it's very dangerous, because it's kind of a jokey term, and I don't think we should joke. I think we should speak about it as if we're talking about Goebbels and Goering and Hitler. And that is what Steve Bannon was trying to do, and Trump has taken it up.
Wow. You just snatched a bunch of wigs up in here. But you guys are part of two amazing documentaries, and you know, we like to end each New Hollywood podcast championing underrepresented voices. Are there any films, documentarians, actors, any underrepresented voices in the industry, writers, that you think deserve more shine right now that aren't getting it?
This isn't really my industry.
Okay. So. But anyone, like you think, like even activism or anyone doing some dope thing.
Honestly, I think the stories of people with severe mental illness is a story that has to be told. Mm. And, you know, in every one of our cities, we walk past someone who's homeless. We walk past someone who is clearly suffering from something. And we are left with no clue on how to hold space for them, respond to them. And we've really created an entire environment where we've invisibilized them. And I think that part of the work that my work is to make the invisible visible and to force not just myself, but the rest of us to be humans again. It is unhuman to walk past someone who is not sheltered, who is clearly pissed on themselves, who clearly needs support. And yet we do it every single day. I do it every single day. And so to put that story on screen and to bring it to Sundance, I think is incredibly important, necessary, and I hope it's a call to action.
Yeah, I'm going to evade your question as well, but I'm going to...
no problem.
But I think that everything you're doing is vital. It's a systemic problem in this country. Every time we even try to fix something and make a big fix, it doesn't really address the fix. And I'll talk about something a little far afield here, but I think it's a metaphor. For instance, Obamacare, which I'm all for. But that doesn't fix the medical industrial complex in this country. It doesn't, and it is related to mental illness very much so. It doesn't help people who really need help and health care. It helped a lot of people that couldn't get health insurance, and that's a great thing, but it does not fix the system. And we need to be radical in the true sense of the term, radical, go to the root of these problems. I'll talk macro. We don't talk about this anymore for some reason, but we're spending way too much money on nuclear arsenals and weapons and things like that. And it's the real problem with the country is that we are locked in by a Senate, for instance, who are, you know, Southern senators have huge, huge power. And they love defense, and they love the military, and we have to spend less on that, and we have to spend more on people and on social issues and come up with radical cures for these problems. And education, of course, is another one that is, it's absurd that we have the defense budget we have, and LA public school teachers went on strike last week because they're not nurses in public schools in LA. So anyway, we have to get radical. And we're all here, this festival does a good job of trying to bring voices, and we're all here in this room because we want to be a part of that. So thank you for giving a topic airing here that is toward that.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys for coming
to
this panel.
Thank you.
Thank you for
Thank you very much. And don't forget, Bedlam, Where's My Roy Cohn, if you guys still are going to be at the festival.
These are great documentaries.
Fantastic.
Guys.
I learned and I can't learn.
The New Hollywood Podcast is presented by Visit West Hollywood. We would also like to thank today's partners, Callie Love, Inkbox, West Elm, and of course, Visit West Hollywood. Pulsing in the heart of LA, West Hollywood is home to the iconic Sunset Strip, diverse Santa Monica Boulevard, and fashion-forward design district. Learn more at visitwesthollywood.com.